Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Great show for you today. Filmmaker and author Don Johnson will be here. Not the movie, not the TV Don Johnson, but filmmaker and author Don Johnson will be here second hour. And we're going to talk about Sola Scriptura with Don. He's got a great, you know what? You'd think nobody's got a new twist on, a new take on Sola Scriptura. Well, Don does. And you're really going to be interested to hear what he has to say. And something we should all consider about how we, the consequences of how we read the Bible. This hour, well, have you been considering leaving the Catholic faith for the East? Or maybe you have made that leap, or maybe that's something at least you are considering. Maybe considering coming into the church, and you think, should I be Orthodox? Because it just seems less something than being Catholic. I don't know what, but it seems less something. If that's you, or maybe you've got someone that you're talking with about these kinds of things, this is the hour for you. Topic this hour, don't leave Rome for Orthodoxy. And Michael Lofton is our guest. Michael's an associate apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the founder of the Reason and Theology podcast, where he's interviewed many of the leading figures in contemporary theology. And you can find him at reasonandtheology.com. He's also a very snappy dresser. I was looking for the right, a very snappy dresser. Boy, you are a sharp looking dude there, Michael Lofton.
We did not actually plan this, by the way.
It's weird that we're wearing the exact same shirt, and it's not even a shirt that you would wear. It's not exact same shirt. Yours looks better than mine, but the red plaid, you don't see a lot of red plaid, but we both decided to wear it today.
I feel like we're both about to go hunting somewhere.
Yeah, but it's a little, like in my state, I don't even know if you're allowed to hunt in California, but I'm sure in Louisiana, you could probably hunt Californians legally. I don't know.
No comment.
888-318-7884 is our number. We love talking about the Catholic faith. We love talking about all the whole broad spectrum of Christianity. And today we'll focus on Orthodoxy and Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Michael, you've been both. So maybe you give us the premise. Why not leave Rome for Orthodoxy?
Yeah, well, I want to first start out by saying I recognize that this can be a very emotional topic because there's a lot of people who are very dissatisfied with things that are going on in the Catholic Church. So they already have an emotional impediment against the Catholic Church, and they're open to looking to alternatives. So for that reason, there's an emotional appeal to Eastern Orthodoxy, and it can seem attractive. But what I want to say is, ultimately, at the end of the day, emotions don't determine what is truth. What is true is going to be determined based on objective truth claims. So when we consider Eastern Orthodoxy, I want to say let's put aside any kind of emotions that we might have involved with, you know, issues that are related to the crisis with the Catholic Church. But let's just ask, okay, are the Orthodox claims true, or are the Catholic claims true? And I think when we analyze Eastern Orthodoxy, it really boils down to the Catholic claims about the papacy. If Catholicism is right about the papacy, Catholicism follows, and it's not going to be a good enough reason to be emotionally dissatisfied with Catholicism and go elsewhere. But I think if the Catholic claims are not true, if they are false, then I would say, okay, then yeah, we need to consider other alternatives. However, I'm very confident that the Catholic claims to the papacy are true, and so that's what I would like to encourage people to look into. I would also point out, if Catholicism is wrong about the papal claims, this actually is not in favor of Eastern Orthodoxy, as you would think. It's actually against Eastern Orthodoxy because there have been many instances throughout church history that the Eastern churches within the Roman Empire, what we would consider now Eastern Orthodox, these Eastern churches, even at our ecumenical councils that we share together with the Orthodox, have accepted the papal claims. So it's if you will, as Eric Ibarra has put it, in their DNA. Mm-hmm. So that if you say that, okay, the Catholic claims about the papacy are false, if you do that, I think you also have to then say, well, Eastern Orthodoxy doesn't logically follow because within its DNA, it has this acceptance of the Catholic papal claims. So yeah. At that point, I just don't think Eastern Orthodoxy logically follows if Catholicism is wrong about the papacy, which it's not.
So, and this is much to be prayed for, I'm sure, but in order, in other words, to be logically consistent, the in whatever form this may happen, the Orthodox Church and the various Orthodox churches need to be in union with the Pope because they don't deny that that union is part of being Catholic or Christian.
They didn't. At various points in history, they didn't deny it. At this point, I think that most Eastern Orthodox, although they have various views on the papacy, I think they would say they deny Vatican I's understanding of the papal claims. The problem is, in their DNA, in their history, they have accepted the substance of the papal claims at Vatican I. So though they may not necessarily accept it today, it's within the DNA, if you will. It's within the history, so that I think if you show that Vatican I is wrong and it's claims about the papacy, I think that that deals a death blow also to Eastern Orthodoxy. But again, I don't believe that that's the case. I believe that it's the case that the papal claims are true. So rather than look elsewhere, I would just say, okay, well, let's consider the papal claims. That is, and when I say papal claims here, I'm mainly talking about papal primacy, you know, the jurisdiction that the church has and the authority that he has over other souls and other bishops, and also papal infallibility properly understood.
Okay.
These are the papal claims, and it is within the first millennium, even within the tradition of some of the Eastern churches. It's even there, as I say, in the ecumenical councils.
888-318-7884 is the number. You are welcome to call, whether you're Catholic, Orthodox, or none of the above. Your calls and questions are welcome. 888-318-7884. Michael, I suppose there's a distinction to be made between the papacy and the papacy as it currently is. And some objections that Orthodox folks have to the papacy as it currently is, they could be incorporated into a different vision of the papacy, a different way of living out that ministry.
This is a really good point, because right now, in the majority of cases, the Pope determines whether or not somebody is going to be appointed a bishop throughout the world. But historically, that certainly wasn't the case with most of the Eastern churches. They tended to have autonomy there. And you could maybe say the Bishop of Rome could intervene in rare cases, but that's about it. He didn't have his, you know, hands on everything when it comes to bishops being appointed bishops. So I think that we could certainly concede that, especially when it comes to the Eastern churches, it doesn't necessarily have to be the way that it is today. But whenever we look at what is the papacy substantially, though it may not be that he has to literally appoint every bishop in the world, it's still is the case that he has a universal jurisdiction, so he does have the right to intervene in the affairs of another bishop, and he does have that spiritual authority as a father throughout Christendom, and he does have an ability to teach infallibly in certain conditions. And I think so, even if we kind of soften the blow and say, well, the papacy doesn't have to look like it does today for you churches in the East, even when we do that, I still think most of them are going to say, but we don't accept Vatican I. Even properly understood, we don't accept it. But the problem is, the substance of the claims of Vatican I are there in the first millennium and even within the ecumenical councils. And we as Catholics and Orthodox, we accept the ecumenical councils. So upon what basis do we reject Vatican I and its understanding of the papacy when it's there in seed form and substance form in the ecumenical councils that we all accept?
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. It's one of those things that gives you the feeling, Michael, and you're an expert in this. I'm amateur at best, but it has the feeling of the longer it goes on, the harder it is to heal it.
I think that's certainly true. However, I mean, with God's grace, this situation can be reversed, but you're right. That certainly is a concern. I'll note that the schism between the Eastern churches and the Roman church happened over a long period of time, and it really started kind of at the local level before it really became something official at the top. So likewise, the way to reverse this is to work on relations on the local level until they finally reach their way to the top. Now, that may take some time. So when you speak about how long this is going to be, I'm afraid that you're right. It's going to take some time to have this healing, because I think it's going to need to happen from the ground up rather than from the top down. When we tried the top down approach at the Council of Florence and also the Council of Lyons, it did not work.
Yeah.
did not work. The Eastern bishops went back to their homes, and the laity in the East did not accept it. Immediately, it was repudiated. So the kind of top-down approach doesn't work. It's going to have to be organic unity that is developed on the local level, and then it's brought to the top. But that's going to take time.
Michael Lofton is our guest from Reason and Theology. You're welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more on Don't Leave Rome for Orthodoxy with Michael Lofton on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because, if you look in the Catechism, you will see the fruits of Holy Communion. And these are remarkable things that we can receive at every Mass that we attend. We encounter the risen Lord, and He shares something of His divine life and love with us.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Next hour, Don Johnson will be here with us to talk about his new book, Twisted Unto Destruction, How Bible Alone Theology Made the World a Worse Place, a fascinating book. Whether you're Protestant or Catholic, you're going to want to be here for that one. This hour, we're talking about orthodoxy in Catholicism with Michael Lofton. Your calls welcome, 888-318-7884. Michael, lines are actually full. I was going to say filling up, but they're full. Shall we go to the phones?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's go to Chase in Wisconsin, watching on our website, Catholic.com. Chase, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Hey, you guys can hear me right, okay?
Yep, you sound good.
Perfect, awesome. I was curious, how can we make the claim that the Roman Catholic Church is united when the Byzantine or the Eastern Catholics, they venerate the Orthodox Saint Gregory Palamas, who was never in the Roman Catholic Church, and he would call the filioque satanic and the Roman Catholic dogma satanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of similar to St. Photius, too. So I think that we have that same situation, not only with Palamas, but also Photius, who also wrote a long treatise on the filioque, although he was under the impression that the Pope backed him up on his rejection of the filioque, ironically. But I understand where you're coming from. This comes up a lot. How is it that within the liturgical calendar of some of the Eastern churches, there can be a veneration of somebody who did not deny in full communion with the Catholic Church and even wrote some things that are problematic? Well, two things. Number one, it's possible for a person to be united to the one true Church of Christ interiorly. Maybe they're not a card-carrying Catholic. Maybe not. Maybe they didn't have formal admission into the Catholic Church. But it's possible for them to be united to the one true Church through interior bonds of faith, hope, and charity. So they could be united to the Church in a mystical way. And we recognize this concept whenever we speak of baptism of desire or somebody who sheds their blood for Christ, but they haven't yet been baptized. We recognize this concept of baptism of blood, a person being united to the Church, though they haven't been washed with the waters of baptism, but they've been united through the grace, if you will, of baptism extra sacramentally. So we already recognize this idea that someone can be part of the Church without actually being a formal member of the Church. So I think that's one thing to consider with some of these saints. And then number two, sometimes they wrote some things that were incorrect. That's true. And we have that problem even within the Latin Rite, because there are figures in the Latin Rite that the Roman Church has accepted that they weren't always orthodox in some of their writings. Here I'm thinking maybe of Gregory of Nyssa. He wrote some great things, and he's a saint both for East and West, but some of his things the Church doesn't accept, just like some things in Augustine the Church doesn't accept. So I think we also need to consider that with factors like Palamas, and what about whenever they write against a dogma of the Catholic Church? I would point this out. I don't believe that Palamas actually understood the proper understanding of what the Catholic Church teaches, or at least, or at the very least, knew that this was something that Christ expected him to adhere to. I truly believe if Palamas knew this was something that was true and he needed to assent to this according to Christ, he would have accepted it. And so I think God is ultimately looking at that disposition. He's not necessarily saying, okay, well, did you get an A on your theology exam? And that's going to be determine whether or not you're going to heaven. He's asking, are you willing to accept this? If you knew that I required it of you, would you assent to this? And I think the answer for Palamas would be yes. So I don't think that it's problematic for Rome to have looked at the liturgical calendar of, say, the Byzantine Catholic Church that I'm part of, to see that Palamas is venerated there and to say, we're going to give approval to that. I don't think it was wrong for Rome to do that.
Okay. Does that make sense, Chase?
Yeah. Can I ask a quick follow-up? I appreciate your time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So if there can be that inward change and you can be part of the church without being, you know, acknowledging the church's dogmas, and if Eastern Orthodox sacraments, then why shouldn't we leave the Catholic Church for Eastern Orthodoxy if they have the sacraments and we can still be a part of the church?
Excellent question. So I want to say that there is much more certitude that you are within God's grace when you are within its formal bounds. When you're outside of the formal bounds of the Catholic Church, you cannot be sure that God forgives you of your sins and that you properly are receiving the grace that is given to you in the sacraments outside of the church. So you're right to note that there is grace available outside of the church in the sacraments of the Orthodox, but the question is, are you properly disposed to receive that grace? Well, you can't know that when you're outside of the formal bounds of the church. It could be that you're properly disposed, that you're not formally, you know, formalizing schism in your heart. It could be the case. But can you really have any kind of moral assurance of that when you're outside of the visible bounds of the church? No. And here, when I'm talking about visible bounds of the church, I'm not talking about the visible bounds of the local church, since they are valid local churches. I'm talking about the visible bounds of the universal church, since the Eastern Orthodox would not be in full communion with the universal church. They're outside of those visible bounds in that sense. And so they can't have a moral certitude that they're properly disposed to receive God's grace, especially whenever they're aware of the Catholic claims. The more you're aware of the Catholic claims, the more responsibility you have to assent to them.
Chase, thank you very, very much. We're talking about Orthodoxy and Catholicism today, the theme of our show. Don't leave Rome for Orthodoxy. Michael Lofton is our guest, and up next is John in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. John, go ahead with your question for Michael.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to try to narrow this down here to a present-day conflict. Through history, the Roman and the Orthodox churches have tried to reconcile several times. There's been the Council of Florence, and I can't remember all the different times in the last 2,000 years, but several efforts to reconcile between the Roman and the Orthodox churches. They've all failed. Currently, we have the Russian Orthodox Church, which is certainly Eastern Orthodox, supporting Putin and Russia in its fight against Ukraine. We have Pope Francis, who has tried to talk to the whatever they call the head man, Kirill, there in the Russian Orthodox Church, and they've got opposite stances on the war in Ukraine. Now, that to me is kind of a flagrant example of the differences between the Roman and the Orthodox churches. The Orthodox, by the way, believe they have the stronger, more disciplined, more traditional approach to Catholicism than does Rome. They think Rome is kind of swayed by the Western liberalization, the Western decadence, et cetera, and the Russians want to maintain the original, Catholic concepts. So that I want to pose that question to you all about the current schism, say, between the Russian Orthodox as the leader of the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Church. What do you think? Is there a way to reconcile anything in the years ahead? A
lot there, John. Michael?
Yeah, let me make sure I'm understanding the question properly. Your question concerns how can we really work towards reconciliation between the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Churches, given some of the positions of the Russian Orthodox Church, especially in Kirill. Is that correct?
That's a good summation of my question. Yeah, how does reconciliation work here nowadays? Yeah. And that's one example of the intense conflict between the two the two churches.
This is a really difficult question, because now we're not talking about reconciliation just with the Eastern Orthodox churches being united. We're now talking about reconciliations with parts of Eastern Orthodoxy that are now divided with each other. So, of course, you mentioned Kirill there. He doesn't recognize the communion of Patriarch Bartholomew, the Patriarch of Constantinople. He also doesn't recognize the communion of the Patriarch of Alexandria. And so you have internal schisms right now within Eastern Orthodoxy. So let's say, theoretically, that we are able to have some kind of reconciliation with Constantinople. Well, that's not going to have any bearings on Russian Orthodoxy, or at least Kirill's branch of it. And so we're now going to have negotiations with individual parts of Eastern Orthodoxy for reconciliation, which again is going to make reconciliation that much harder, which is why I argue it's not good that the Eastern Orthodox right now are suffering this partial or internal schism, because that's going to make it so much harder for us to work towards reunion. We need them unified, because it's a lot easier to talk to a unified group than a divided group when it comes to reconciliation. So I agree, this is a huge problem.
John?
And in response, I wasn't aware of the fragmentation within the Eastern Orthodox. Thank you for pointing that out. And that makes it much more difficult, like you're saying, to negotiate with any of them in the Eastern Orthodox. So my question kind of goes back to Our Lady of Fatima. At Fatima and other places, she has suggested that we ought to have one Catholic faith throughout the world, starting or spreading to Russia. Russia needs a Catholic faith, as opposed to an Eastern Orthodox faith. So, you know, where do we go? This could be decades and decades more before any progress is made.
Well, I certainly believe that we need to be united with the Eastern Orthodox, or they need to also, I should say, be united with us. But as far as Fatima, it's actually curious. There's some internal evidence there with the message of Sister Lucy that what she intended when she meant by Russian Orthodoxy, well, I should say Russia being converted, she actually intended that it would return to its Orthodox roots. Now, whether or not it would return to its Orthodox roots and then return to reunion with Rome is a different issue. But I do want to point that out, because that, of course, did happen in Russia. So it seems to vindicate the Fatima message. But yeah, I certainly agree that we need to have reconciliation and unity with the Russian Orthodox, sure.
And John was saying that he wasn't aware of the splits within Orthodoxy. Many of those are just within the last few years.
Yes, just within the last few years, and still ongoing.
And it really is tragic. It's something we Catholics certainly pray for, the unity of the Orthodox. It's not doing anybody, I think that it's not doing anybody any good, this division.
It's horrible. It just further fragments Christianity, and we want to work towards reconciliation, not further division.
Thanks, John. I'm going to go to Joseph now out here in California, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Joseph, go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Okay, first of all, should the form of the Eucharist be important for unity, and shouldn't Catholics use a loaf instead of individual hosts to symbolize this unity?
Some Catholics do use loaves in the Eastern Catholic churches mostly. But I think you're thinking of in the Latin Rite, where unleavened bread is used. Although historically in the Roman Rite, historically, especially in the first millennium, the Roman Rite tended to use leavened bread, loaves. But so whenever the Roman Rite started to go to unleavened bread, you started to have some pushback with the East, and you started to have some bickering and fighting between Romans and Greeks, as they call them, you know, Latins and Greeks. You started to have fights here over the particular form of, you know, of the Eucharist, leavened or unleavened. And I think we all agree at this point that those were petty debates. Even though historically they did not see them as petty debates, and they really felt that they were justifiable reasons for schism and disunity, I think we all agree at this point, for the most part, Catholics and Orthodox, that such things don't really break communion. It's fine if some liturgies, you know, if they use leavened bread and others use unleavened bread. That's not something substantial to the sacrament of the Eucharist, so we can have differences there.
What do you think, Joseph?
Well, I don't, I'm not, the point is not unleavened to leaven. To me, because you can have an unleavened loaf.
The point
is that you have, whether you have a loaf and it is broken and distributed so that when the individual, like Roman Catholics, receive, they're not just receiving an individual little particle.
Right.
They're receiving an actual part of what's broken.
Broken. You're breaking up a little bit, Joseph, but we got the point. Yeah, you're receiving from the loaf, and it's a sign of the unity of the Church. And the unit, the communion that we are in with one another and with God through Jesus Christ. And so you can probably hear the music, Joseph. I'll let Michael make a comment on that when we come back, but we got to take a quick break. What's our theme today? Well, the theme for this hour, don't leave Rome for Orthodoxy. If you've got questions in that regard, maybe challenges, 888-318-7884.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at shop.catholic.com or pick it up at a good Catholic bookstore. As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, having a good time with Michael Lofton. We accidentally wore the same shirt today, so that looks a little weird. It looks like we called each other before, but we didn't. Michael Lofton, of course, the proprietor of Reason and Theology, and you can find him at reasonandtheology.com. And the question before us comes from Joseph here in California, and he was just reiterating that the problem is he's not referring to whether the bread is leavened or unleavened in communion, but in the Latin rite, we don't all eat from the same consecrated loaf. Everybody gets their own individual wafer, and that this seems to be bad symbolism to Joseph.
Might you argue that it would be ideal to share from the same loaf? I think you could make that argument, but I would never make the argument that somehow Roman Catholicism is deficient because it doesn't have that symbolism, because there's other symbolism that none of us have in the Eucharist. And so, again, there's other biblical symbolism that we might not have in the particular forms that our liturgical tradition has where we administer the Eucharist. So, you argue that it might be better to show the unity that we have, perhaps, but is that really something essential? I don't think so.
We're talking about Orthodoxy and Catholicism today. If you've got a question, if you've got a comment, you got a challenge for Michael Lofton, you are welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. We're going to New Jersey now. John in New Jersey listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. John, go ahead with your question for Michael.
Hi, Michael. Hello, gentlemen. Real quick, the context for my question is this. So I am Orthodox,
raised Roman Catholic, loved the Catholic experience, raised in a very good, faithful family, prayerful family, church every Sunday, grew into the Orthodox Church, and loved the Orthodox liturgical experience as well. So my heart is for unity between the East and the West. And the context is this for my question. That is, historically, my understanding of church history was that the East always organized themselves with the local bishop within a region as being sovereign within his local region. And the West, obviously, you know, developed the papacy and had the leadership of the Pope. And we functioned that way. You know, Eastern and Western Christendom were one till 1054. It wasn't until the Great Schism that separated. But we had different governing styles. And what I look at history, I see that there were times when the East would veer towards heresy and the West pulled it back. And the times when the West veered towards heresy and the East pulled it back. There was a great value in seeing Christendom through the eyes of the East and the West. Why couldn't we, I would say that if we think we're going to get the East to accept a different church governance, I don't think it's going to happen. But why couldn't we, I'll be optimistic on this level, why couldn't we at least start talking and moving towards intercommunion between two sister churches that have a very, you know, a common history for 1,000 years, the ecumenical councils, but we do look at things a little bit differently, and why can't we accept those small differences, I consider them small, and move towards intercommunion?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I wouldn't accept the way you described the first millennium there. I would not accept that there were two different views of ecclesiology, one particular to the Eastern churches and one particular to the Western churches. There were all kinds of ecclesiologies in the first millennium, but there's a lot of overlap where the Eastern churches were accepting the papal understanding of government and the papacy being essential to the constitution and structure of the church. There's plenty of examples where the East accepted that. And there's also examples where some in the West rejected the papacy in those claims. So I don't think that we can paint East or West in those colors. There's all kinds of ecclesiologies in the first millennium, and you can't just say, well, the West was this way, the East was this way. I don't accept that historically. But number two, I would say I agree with you that we can't call the Eastern churches to a different ecclesiology than their roots. But that's the point. We're just simply calling the Eastern churches to their roots and to the ecclesiology that they accepted, at least at the ecumenical councils. And that ecclesiology included the papacy as essential to the government of the church, not something dispensable, not something that they could be outside of communion with. And so I would say, yeah, we don't need to impose any kind of ecclesiology on them that's foreign to them. We simply need to call them to accept their own roots. And then number three, as far as intercommunion with the Orthodox, yeah, sure, on the local level in certain cases, as long as there isn't scandal, the Catholic Church accepts that we can have a level of intercommunion in certain cases. And I actually think that's helpful in working towards reunion on the local level. And hopefully that will bubble up to the top one day.
Liam, I'm anxious to hear what you think. Oh, excuse me. I said the wrong name. That's our next caller is Liam. John, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think your response was great. My only question and question for clarity is I don't recall in terms of church history the East ever accepting a bishop of any region over another region, a bishop's region. Now, they always accepted the leadership of the Pope in the sense of being the highest among equals. There was always a leadership and a position of honor, of leadership to the Pope of Rome. That's clear. But I've never seen in church history where there was actual imposition of one bishop over another bishop. That I haven't seen. And that's, I think, what led to the Great Schism in 1054.
I know that's a popular myth, but I would say it's a myth. That's not accurate. I would not say it's accurate that they just merely accepted a first among equals. No, there was actually more authority behind the Bishop of Rome, and many in the East accepted that in the first millennium. As far as councils, first of all, at the Council of Ephesus, you could see the papal legate there, Philip the Legate, speaking about the Pope as head of an ecumenical council, head to members, the bishops there being the members, the Pope is the head. My question then is, if the Pope is the head, how can you really survive at this point with an ecclesiology that doesn't have a head. Now you have a church that's headless. So I think that already what we see there in Ephesus shows that the Pope is essential to the constitution of the church. But it gets much more explicit with the formula of Hermisdas and the Eastern Orthodox signing off on the papal claims made in the formula of Hermisdas in the 6th century. It gets even more detailed in Agatho's letter to the emperor at the 6th Ecumenical Council, where he's speaking about the papal claims of supremacy and infallibility. The bishops there are signing off on that, accepting that. That's certainly something that would say there's more than honor being given to the Pope. He actually has universal paternity, if you will, over the other bishops, and that's being recognized there at the 6th Council, and especially it's evident at the 7th Ecumenical Council under Pope Hadrian, and some of his letters that are recognized at the council and read at the council. So I would say when you look at those letters that are accepted by the councils, they're making claims about the Pope that's way more than just a primacy of honor. It's actually one that requires for them to be in communion with the Pope and has a moral coercion, if you will. In other words, you're supposed to listen to what he's saying in certain cases, and if you don't, you're in sin. It's not something that we're just free to dismiss.
John.
So I guess I would challenge that.
Okay. John, I'm going to leave it there and let as many on as I can. Thank you so much for the call and for, I think we do all share the hope for a unity among all of us, and appreciate that, John. Now, I said Liam's name before when I meant to say John, because both are in New Jersey. Both are listening on Channel 130. EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio. So I got myself all confused. But Liam, I'm sorry I did that to you. Go ahead with your question for Michael.
That's okay. It's fine. I'm very interested in this subject. I was part of a group in our little chapel here in Newark, New Jersey, that we wrote a letter to Cardinal Tobin and to the Vatican, to the Pope, requesting the Pope to issue a motu proprio about laying out the case for a motu proprio for reconciling the dates of Easter. And it was our belief, after much discussion, that the reconciliation of the dates of Easter would bring so much grace out of heaven that all of these little schisms that are going on and the big schism that's going on will be healed and the whole church would be reunited as one body. And I wanted to see what your guests thought the chances of the dates of Easter being reconciled between the churches was.
Well, there certainly is talk about working towards this in the coming years. But I don't think that this would solve all of the problems. I mean, if God wants to end the separation that way, he certainly can. But I guess I just don't see that as being something that would necessarily do so, because you would still have differences that we have in ecclesiology, especially the papacy. We would still have issues that we need to work through there. We would still even, believe it or not, have issues left with the filioque to deal with, among some other doctrines. So even if we were to share a same date for Easter, I don't see how that would fix those problems. And those are the real problems that are keeping us. Yeah.
I agree. I don't think reconciling the dates will fix the problems, but I think that reconciling the dates will bring so much joy out of heaven into the earth that the other problems will begin to pass away shortly.
Perhaps.
I guess that's just my opinion, but I wanted to see what you thought, because I've thought what you've said so far has been very intelligent and obviously educated. So,
you know, thank you, and I appreciate the question. The issue with the date of Easter and a lack of unity here has been a problem that we've had going back to the early days of the first millennium. We've had this trouble for a long time. Constantine tried to fix it at Nicaea 1, and it didn't really go too well. So we've been struggling over this issue. But I guess I would just still say that even if we were to have that, I don't know if that would necessarily be something that would fix everything. But we could certainly hope for it.
Liam, thanks. We got to take our break, though, and we do have a few lines open. If you'd like to get your question in or your comment or If you have a problem, you know, that maybe that someone in the family has or a friend has that you'd like to address, you know, the claim made about the Catholic Church, about Orthodoxy, because we're talking about the Catholic Church and Orthodoxy this hour with Michael Lofton, you are very welcome here, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
So I've been a Catholic all my life. Recently, this can be a little bit weird, but I've been struggling a lot lately. I deal with a lot of personal issues. I feel like a bad person. I feel like I'm not worthy of God's love.
You are not alone. And many of the people that you think have it all together just have less courage than you do to come forward with their weaknesses.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour is Michael Lofton from Reason and Theology. Check it out at reasonandtheology.com if you want to get in on the conversation about Orthodoxy and Catholicism. 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Your calls are very, very welcome. 888-31-TRUTH if you prefer it in the spelled format. Just an impression that that you get, and I'll go back to. We have several callers that I'm going to go back to, but is your sense that the dialogue is getting us anywhere, or does it sometimes feel like we're just pounding our head against the wall?
I feel like it's getting us somewhere in some circles, okay. But on the popular level, especially online in apologetic circles, no.
Online doesn't help anything, does it?
No. You're right about that, but it more in the more informed circles. Yeah, I think we're starting to see more unity. Uh-huh. But again, we need this on the popular level first, because we can't have another top-down solution. It did not work when we tried it before. Probably won't work it if we try it again.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Zenaf in Dallas, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Zenaf, go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Sam. My question is, if I decide to go for confession through an Orthodox priest, not out of the absolute necessity, just out of my own, you know, volition, will that be okay within the Catholic Church? I know the priest within the Orthodox Church is valid.
So if you're a baptized Catholic or you're in the Catholic Church, you're to follow the Code of Canon Law. And the Code of Canon Law notes that unless you have some kind of physical or moral inability to go to a Catholic priest, that you would go to a Catholic priest for the sacraments. But if you, again, have a physical or moral impediment, then you could go to a non-Catholic minister who has apostolic succession, valid sacraments. So you could go to them in that case. For example, confession to an Orthodox priest. But again, that's if you're physically or morally unable to go to someone who's Catholic. And physical here means you're unable to physically get to a Catholic priest. Maybe he's 3 hours away. And morally, one example could be, let's say, you know, your employer won't let you leave at that time and you have to work for them. Or you're 15 years old and your parents won't let you, you know, go to a Catholic church or something like that. That's going to be a moral impediment. Aside from that, you're supposed to go to a Catholic minister to receive the sacraments. So canonically, the answer would be no.
Okay, Zenaf?
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
Sure. No problem.
This is something I really don't know, Michael, but in the celebration of the sacraments, are there significant, like, I don't know how they celebrate confession in the Orthodox churches. Are there significant differences in the, like, just in what I would experience, say, for example, if I walk into confession or to receive one of the other sacraments?
Depends on who you ask. But since you're asking me, I'll tell you according to me. Because some people are going to make mountains out of molehills here.
Okay.
Because there is a different form of absolution that is given. It's more of a passive kind of form of absolution in the East, whereas in the Roman Rite, it's active. I absolve you of your sins. You know, There's that active form. Well, it's more passive in the East, and so some Orthodox are going to make a mountain out of molehill there with the differences there. But I don't think that that's essential to the sacrament. You'll probably notice some differences. I mean, just depending on where you go, it's most likely going to be in front of the iconostasy, so in front of an icon stand that you'll be doing confession rather than in a room or something like that. It's a little less rigid as far as how you're confessing it. You're still obligated, right, of course, to mention all of your mortal sins, but I suppose it's a little less rigid in how specific you might be. There are some different prayers at the end that are given that differ from those in the Roman Rite. But on the whole, it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, just accidental differences.
Right, which you would expect with about 1,000 years of separation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Let's go to Josh in Boise, Idaho, listening on Salt and Light Radio. Josh, go ahead with your question for our guest, Michael Lofton.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious on why there's not the 3-bar crucifix recognized really anywhere, and I'm not pushing for it, but just recognized anywhere in the Latin side.
Yeah. Now, I don't know about in the Latin side. I have seen, I think, something that's 3-bar, but it's different than the 3-bar you're referring to, the Eastern one. I think I've seen a papal crucifix that is 3 bars. They're all at the top rather than one of the bars at the bottom. The third bar that you're referring to there represents the footrest, by the way, the footrest of Jesus on the cross. And it's representative of some of the Eastern churches. But you do have it in the Byzantine Catholic Church, so you have it in some of the Eastern Catholic churches, but you're right. I guess I really haven't seen that a whole lot in the Latin Rite, but it's just kind of a minor thing, minor difference.
Yeah, and because I think it's kind of significant and fascinating that their tradition with why the bottom, pardon me, the bottom bar is crooked, you know, when Jesus took his last breath, and it was a very symbolic moment for that bottom bar to become crooked. Thought more should know about it.
Yeah, and of course there's a historical debate on whether or not there was a footrest, by the way, so there's that element that we have to consider.
Sure. Josh, thanks very much. Let's go to Jim in Wyoming, also listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jim, thank you for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Yeah, my question was, if we were a unified church with the Orthodox for the first 1,000 years, how did they lose the teaching on purgatory? I know there's some disagreement in the church. Some of them teach there is spiritual toll houses, some form of purgatory, and others teach that that's absolutely wrong. One of my big problems with the Orthodox Church, but how did they lose that teaching?
I wouldn't say that they lost it, but they certainly don't call it purgatory, and they might see it differently than the way it's been expressed in some historical parts of the Roman Rite. And so historically in the Roman Rite, you see this tendency of referring to purgatory as, the purgatorial fires, as a literal fire. And the East kind of pushed back on that, and they were saying, we don't have this tradition of purgatorial fires. The only fires we know about are the fires of hell. So what is this temporary fire? Are you denying the eternality of hell? So there was this huge debate on what we meant by that. And really the consensus from that debate, it came out from that where we recognized that, okay, the fires of purgatory, they're not literal. It could be the encounter with Christ as God is a purifying fire. That could be the fires of purgatory that we're referring to. It doesn't have to be a literal thing. Understood in that way, that's much more representative of the East. But there are some differences there. They certainly agree that you can pray for the dead. but whether or not there's penance that could be performed for the dead, that's something different. But some of our practices of penance kind of developed in the second millennium anyway. So I wouldn't say that the East doesn't have a concept of purgatory, but they're not going to call it that. And they are going to differ in the way they describe it than the way some in the Roman Rite have described it historically.
Okay, Jim?
Yeah, I guess some of the people I've been watching on the internet might not speak authoritatively for the Orthodox Church then, because I've seen some of them reject it outright.
Reject purgatory outright?
Yeah, I've seen that as well. But if you ask them, but you pray for the dead, right? They're going to say yes. Okay. And you do agree that you encounter a living God who is a purifying fire when you die, right? They're going to say yes. Okay. Well, you've accepted purgatory even if you don't realize it.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, thanks very, very much. Appreciate that. I'm going to go to, as you can tell, I'm trying to get everybody on here. I'm going to go to Augusta, Georgia. Joseph, listening on 91.1 FM. Go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment on the question about whether or not it would be better to share communion from a common loaf of bread. And just add, in addition to all the good things that you said, that our true unity is in the body of Christ, which we receive in His true presence in the Eucharist. So that's that's bigger than, you know, how the bread's cut up or the pieces and their shape. That's all.
We're receiving the same Christ, so we have that ultimate unity. But as just far as the liturgical expression, might we say that it's good to demonstrate that by sharing from the same loaf? Sure. We certainly do that in the Eastern traditions, but I don't think that anyone in the Latin Rite is really losing anything by not having that symbolism. I think that they're receiving the same Lord, so, and that's the ultimate unity that we're really looking for, not in symbolism, but in reality. And we all have that in the reality that we're truly receiving the same Lord Jesus Christ.
Joseph, I'm going to say thanks and keep moving because I want to get everybody on. Orlando in Forest Hills, Louisiana, listening on the Catholic Answers app. You're going to have to be quick if you'd like an answer, Orlando. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, my question is, do Orthodox recognize saints from the Catholic Church after schism, just like the Catholic Church recognizes some of theirs?
They tend to not recognize saints after the schism, although it's debatable when we're going to date the schism, but they tend to not recognize them, at least officially and liturgically. Maybe privately some of them would, but not officially. But they also have a problem here because they have some people that they venerate who were never in communion with the Eastern Orthodox churches, who are, for example, non-Chalcedonians. So they kind of have the same issue of venerating saints that weren't in full communion with them.
Okay.
Thanks, Orlando.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I mean, so much of the veneration of saints, it's so orderly now, but for much of the life of the church, it was kind of popular acclaim later,
yes,
getting a stamp of approval from officials that made someone a saint.
Yeah, it was on a popular level. There wasn't a pope saying, okay, here's a saint, I'm now declaring him a saint for a lot of the first millennium. It was more popular piety, people on a local level venerating somebody, and they just, again, by popular piety, kind of rise to the level of a saint in that territory.
Michael Lofton is our guest. Reason and Theology is where you can find him. How much of this type of conversation do you have over at Reason in Theology? Like questions about Orthodoxy and Catholicism?
Very often, because it's something really dear to my heart. So I try to discuss Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism very often.
So we Catholics, we pick on each other. You know, we've got all these different groups that we just love to attack one another. Are there groups that attack Michael Lofton? Like, oh, that guy is one of these. Do you get any of that?
Nonstop. About an hour before this video, something just came up on social media. Yeah.
Okay, that's the way we model the life of Christ in our hearts. It's by attacking one another online. It's a beautiful tradition that has developed ever since they invented Twitter. Michael Lofton, we love it when you're on, and I especially love your choice of clothing. Thanks so much for doing this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
I hope people will check out your work at reasonandtheology.com. Coming up next, we're going to talk about sola scriptura, but not the way we usually type. It's not going to be Catholic proofs against sola scriptura, or, you know, why you should believe in the authority of the church, that kind of thing. No, no. It's a look at the consequences in real human history of the sola scriptura doctrine with John Johnson right after this on Catholic Answers Live.